นุคัมภมานัสสะอิเมสะคะเรตุกัตถะภานะคะระบุเตภาติกัมหาสุอัมหาคังทีฆาลตังทิพายะสุขายะอะระหังสัมมาสัมพุทโธภะคะวะพุทธังภะคะวันตังอภิวาเทมิสุวาคาโตภะคะวะตาธัมโมธัมมังนะมัสสามิสุปัฏฐิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆสังฆังนะมามินะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอิติปิโสภะคะวะอะระหังสัมมาสัมพุทโธวิจาจารณสัมปันโนสุขโตโลกวิทุอนุตตรโภคุริสสธัมมสารถิสัทธาเทวมนุสานังพุทโธภะคะวะธัมมังภะคะวันตังอภิปุจจยามิธัมมังภะคะวันตังสิรสานะมามิสุปัฏฐิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆอุชุปัฏฐิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆยายะปัฏฐิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆสามีสิปัฏฐิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆยะทิฏฐังชัตถาริภุริสายุคานิอัตถภุริสภุกะเอสาภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆอะหุเนโยภะหุเนโยตะคิเนโยอัญจะลิกะรัญโยอนุตตรังปุญญะเขตังโลกัสสะธัมมังสังฆังอภิปุจจยามิธัมมังสังฆังสิวตานะมามิ
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud on demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let monks deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as the Father protects with his life his child, his only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain his recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
I was thinking of, instead of saying by not holding to false news, but by not listening to fake news.
You can't change it anymore, Ajahn.
Okay.
You can't.
No.
It's been written.
Oh, yeah, no, but that's fake. No. Yeah. Very good. So, that's what we've got today. This is, we've got time. Question one. Do psychopaths and people that have done incredibly evil things like Chris Watts, who killed his own family, have good a nature? Chris Watts, who was he?
That guy.
I don't know. Anyway, psychopathy. It's very nice to treat people with all the different types of healings. You've got allopathy, homeopathy, and psychopathy.
Brain.
No, psychopath, again, putting people into categories. They're psychopaths, they are sociopaths, they are all these little categories. We love to put people into these categories. And once we put them into that category, it's as if they're locked in there. They're a psychopath because they've been told they're a psychopath forever. And so, is that really the case? Or is it that a person has done psychopathic things? hasn't even identified with that label and just lives up to it. That is the sort of the dangerous thing which, I know I argue with people on this one, but otherwise, what can you do with a psychopath? It's just like they're there forever. And that doesn't really match with similes like the 1,000-petal lotus. Surely inside is something. They're still a human being. So there may be something, some even like damage or short-circuiting to the brain. But the mind is something totally different than the brain. And that's actually why that when we're just so materialist, we measure people by material stuff. And then what about the sort of the mind? And that's why there's so many times, whether it's through hypnosis, though actually you can get through to sort of some other parts of a person. There's a really nice documentary I saw a long time ago about this gentleman in England who just lost his memory. And of course he couldn't actually explain what happened because he couldn't remember anything. And then through hypnosis, and he just got recently married. And then he couldn't recognize his own wife, which was very disconcerting for her. They'd only been married a couple of months. And anyway, what happened, they put him under hypnosis, and he recalled what had happened, that this was some years ago, he was off in his workshop in the back of his garden, in England, and a telephone rang before mobile phones. He could hear it in his house. He ran out of the workshop, trying to get to the main part of the house to answer the phone, and he literally hit his head on an open shutter of the workshop. And apparently that knocked his memory out. And under hypnosis, he could remember everything. But, they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion, you will remember, everything, but when they came out, he couldn't. And it was fascinating that just on one part, your mind cannot remember everything, but your brain can't. Because it's somehow been so dislodged from your brain. So, even if somebody was a psychopath, what do you mean they are psychopaths? Is that their identity? That doesn't really fit with the idea of anatta and non-self and five khandhas, always being able to change. So that's the five components of existence. So I think what Buddhism can do, it can give actually a pathway for a psychopath to actually access something else and heal. So, have Buddha nature? Sure. Did Devadatta have Buddha nature? Trying to kill the Buddha? Certainly, in a sense, I had something beautiful inside him, the potential to be fully enlightened. So, I would actually say, in the sense of Buddha nature, that can he eventually, this fellow Chris Watts, can he eventually just be a good, kind person? Yeah. Psychopaths, are they really permanent, unable to change, as stable as a iron post, as the simile was in the suttas? So, can change? No, people do change. Harder, more difficult. But if that mind can be reached, why not? Okay, nice. One of the nice stories is that this young man, this gives hope to you all that anyone can get enlightened. This young boy in northeast of Thailand, that he went to school, grade one, and after 1 year of grade one, the teacher failed him. He said, I can't pass you. You haven't learnt on being able to do stick pictures properly or crayoning or I don't know what he failed in. So we're going to have to hold you back for another year. So this young man, all his friends, they went on to grade two and he stayed in grade one. And then the second year, the teacher had to fail him again. Hadn't made progress. The best will in the world, nope, I'm sorry. So he did grade one three times. and three times he failed grade one. Now, if you've got a kid who you think is disabled intellectually, then, you know, that's it going. I don't know how actually you can do that for failed grade one three times. So, but what do they do in the villages in Thailand? This was actually before I became a monk even. So what can you do is you can't even just know one end of a water buffalo from another. So people like that, there's only one place they can send them to. The monastery. So they sent him to the village monastery, ordained him as a novice, and the head monk was trying his best, so patient, to teach him some chanting. Because every monk, none has to know some chanting. So they teach him Namo Tassa. And so it took him weeks and weeks to master Namo. And then they went on to Tassa. And then, so he got Tassa. What was that first word again? Of course, that's an exaggeration. I'm making much of this up. But, you know, that was a basic story, that he spent a couple of years in the village monastery, and the abbot just at the village monastery, with all the kindness and patience and endurance, said, look, this is hopeless, impossible. So where to send him next? And there's only one place such people, monks, can go, and that's the forest monastery. But not all monks and nuns in forest monasteries started off like that. But this is what happened next. The teacher in the forest monastery taught him basic meditation. And he had such a simple mind, so peaceful, very few thoughts, that he soon mastered all these deep meditations and became enlightened, an arahant. And he had to do chanting, even as a senior monk, eventually. And the reason, the way he did his chanting, apparently, was that because he had incredible meditation, that he managed to access his previous lives. In one of his previous lives, he was a monk, and he had mastered the chanting. His brain was much better in the previous life. And so whenever he had to do any chanting, like, you know, we do the blessing chants, he actually would focus, just connect with his previous life and use that for his memory to chant. Weird. But what it was just in this life, his brain was just unable to have that ability to memorize. But he compensated in this very peaceful, simple mind, which could get into deep meditation so easy. So people have some abilities, they're lacking in others, but you can compensate. So, even psychopaths, maybe there's another part to them, if you can just access that, and of course there is. That's not all they are. But of course you have to be careful, because sometimes people just overestimate their abilities to change others. Ajahn, Anatta, that's my quarter of a question. Less is more. Okay. If that's a quarter of a question, then no is the quarter of my answer. And you get the other three quarters tomorrow. Well, it's fair, fair. You give a quarter of a question, then I give a quarter of an answer. Okay, anyway, here we go. Where can I find a translation of the chant that nuns and monks sing at lunchtime? Sing at lunchtime? Will you be singing? They're not supposed to sing. It's against our rules. What have you been up to when I've been over at Bodhinyana? That's one of the rules. We're not allowed to sing. So, when one occasion, we were doing a fundraiser, I think, for the nuns' monastery. We're just starting it off. Was it Janagra? One of the two, anyway. And doing a fundraiser, and the host of the fundraiser, I won't say who she is, but she handed me the microphone and showed me a $10,000 check. She said, I will give this to the nuns' monastery if you sing a song. And I said, but it's breaking my precepts. He said, well, just, you know, what's more important? So getting a good nun's monastery or breaking some precepts. And I said, okay, I've already made many sacrifices for the nun's monastery. I'm prepared to make another sacrifice on one condition. And the condition was that you let me choose the song and that you hand me the check before I start singing. And so she handed me the check, and I said, I had the microphone right in front of me, and said, the song which I choose is a classic song by Simon and Garfunkel, The Sound of Silence. And I was quiet for 3 or 4 minutes and said, there we go. That's my version of The Sound of Silence. I actually did that. And so she let me. She didn't cancel the check, thank goodness. But, you know, you can't outwit a monk. So, the chant the nuns monks sing at lunchtime, I don't know. Where can you find it? Page 34. There we go. There's the answer. Okay. If omega equals 1, then what about nothingness and shunyata? Shouldn't omega equal 0? It only means 1 because it's perfectly balanced. So, then when it comes together, that's why I know that they had this old joke that when a Buddhist goes to McDonald's and they ask, what do you want? And he says, make me one with everything. That's not a good Buddhist. Instead, the Buddhist goes up and they say, make me none with everything. This, in other words, one is just, there's still something there. So, what was it? I do get involved in sort of interfaith work and stuff, and so there was one, I forget who it was, I don't know if it was a Christian monk or a Christian layperson or a priest or something. I was going over to, where was it? I think it must have been Singapore or Hong Kong or somewhere. And anyway, they said to me, because, you know, we're having a conversation, and he said to me, you know, when he thought he'd softened me up, he went for the killer blow to try and convert me. He said, you have to admit, Ajahn Brahm, that nothing is higher than God. And I looked at him and said, actually, I think you're right. I agree with you. And he smiled. And he thought he had me. And then I said, yes, nothing, emptiness, is far superior than any being, any God. So nothing is better than anything. And he looked at me and said, that is not what I meant. But 0 is much more profound than 1. So instead of being the One, apparently there was a movie or something, The One, and that was, I think they said The Matrix or something. I had to find The One. They said, if I was writing the script for that movie, The One is not the thing, the None. Is higher than the One. Anyway, nothingness and shunyata. Shouldn't omega equal 0? Now, omega is the balance. So everything is balanced, a positive, negative energy. So when it all comes together, 0. Because that's what sometimes people ask. You know, it's just a basic science principle. You can't create mass energy. You can either transfer mass into energy, energy into a mass. But it's called the law of the conservation of energy. So where could this universe come from? Because energy has to be conserved, so it can come from 0. Splitting up. So from positive to negative, the sum total is still zero. And then it comes together. And it doesn't have a bang. It just disappears. Just like you. Where did you come from? Nothing. And the mind, anicca, up and down, always balancing. If it all came together, that's why you meditate, all come together. Ekagata, come into oneness of the mind. It all balances out, because omega equals one, which means it all balances, so when it comes together, you vanish and disappear. Oh, that's really good. Sounds anyway, it's really good. I should go on a TED talk and do that, but with all of the zero, it all comes together. And then, you know, they probably could use some visual effects. When I said this, then I vanished too. That'd be really cool. I'm sure you can do that with some visual effects. What is a best Buddhist response to Donald Trump from a disgruntled American? Donald Trump is fake news. He believes in fake news. So what you believe is what you become. Okay, whatever, I don't know. Anyway, your response to fake news is, I just really was so irritated by mosquitoes when I was in Thailand. And we would try and ask Ajahn Chah, look, please, can we have some mosquito repellent? They got it in the shops. Or mosquito coils. Or can we have mosquito screens on the huts? You know, they're driving us crazy. And he said, from now on, you must call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. You learn so much from the irritating parts of your life. So if you've got an irritating husband or an irritating wife, please call him Ajahn Husband. Ajahn Wife. So the Buddhist response would start calling him Ajahn Trump. You learn a lot from your mistakes. Anyway, how to relax my body and mind. I have insomnia and tension when I meditate. I'm glad you have insomnia when you meditate. Because I don't want people falling asleep when they're meditating. Maybe I didn't punctuate that properly. I have to relax my body and mind. I have insomnia and tension when I meditate. I don't know where the tension comes from. Please help. Thank you. Remember this string simile. Tension means there's something pulling it in one direction, pulling it in the other direction. You need something pulling, stretching to have tension. So sometimes it's what is stretching is where you want to be, where you want to go. Some problem from the past is just pulling you back into old memories. There's something pulling and stretching, and it gets too tight. That's why we can't go to sleep. Past or future, pulling us. So it's nice to imagine this like a string being pulled at both ends, and you're the string. So what's doing the pulling? Where do you want to go in the future? Nowhere. I'm in bed. This is nice. This is time out. Sleep time. What about the past? Ah, come on. The past is gone. Cannot be changed. So one thing is when you're in bed at night, you can do the... Okay, this is one of those similes I haven't done yet. One of the similes is the two heavy suitcases simile. Maybe if I remember this, because I don't plan things, and that's As I told you, that's when I gave that simile, that presentation at one of the hospitals in Singapore about dementia. And when the expert, the doctor, he's a professor, sorry, when he started saying the signs of dementia, that you just forget the past and you just can't really visualize the future and you're socially disengaged. You've got it. That's what I've been teaching people in Singapore for years. It's my fault. You let go of the past. You let go of the future and you just live simply disengaged. That's one of the signs of dementia. But there's other signs as well. So anyway, so the tension is pulling and pushing you. This is one of those little similes, which I love doing. I have to sort of put my robe on properly. This lady came to see me in Nonamara, and she said, quite a successful lady already, says, this is where I am in my life, in my career. And this is where I know I can reach. This is where I know I should be in my life, in my career, in my wealth, in my family, in the respect, and just all of the the achievements in my career. I know I can get up here, but I'm always down here. Every time I try to get up, you get up so far and something stops me. And it's just a little suffering. Can you please help me to actually to reach where I know I should be in life? So easy. So this is where you are. This is where you want to be. So how about knowing where you want to be to where you are? So if you're stupid, just don't try to be clever. Just be content to be stupid, then you're happy. You're at peace with yourself. If you've got insomnia, then it's this, I don't want insomnia, I want to be awake. And then so, take awakefulness to where insomnia is, and then you're at peace with yourself. You're one with where you really are, not where you want to be. We can't do that, we think. The trouble with insomnia or whatever is a lot of times it's the mental problem. I don't want this. I want it to be different. I want to go somewhere else where this problem doesn't exist. Imagine, just imagine, being content with whatever physical or emotional problem you have. Being happy to be here. You all know, I hope, the simile of the prison. What is a prison? A prison isn't a place where you're locked up at night. Actually, you're locked up here, aren't you? You're not supposed to go out. Where you're told what time to get up. That's here. Where you can only eat what's given to you, and you can't do this, and you can't watch TV unless you're really good or whatever. You know, there's many things which are so similar to a monastery and being in prison. In fact, in a prison, you're allowed to do so many more things. And it's far more comfortable. I've visited many prisons. And you look at those prisons, you look at monastery, and actually the prison is far more comfortable. You can play sport in prisons. You can actually do all sorts of stuff. But what makes a prison, and what makes Jhana Grove reformatory? Penitentiary. You're here because of your bad karma from the past. Are you? Doing penance? Wearing off all your old bad karma? Of course not. You're here because you want to be here. And a prison, the only reason they call it a prison, because all the people there don't want to be there. That's the only difference. So, are you in a prison now? Any place you don't want to be, you're not happy being here, qualifies as a prison. And you try to escape. I've got insomnia. I don't want insomnia. I'm going to try and escape from that. Your insomnia is a prison for you. even if you have physical pain, disappointment, this is where you are and this is where you know you should be. Change where you know you should be to where you are. And then you're never in prison anywhere. There will come a time in your life, for all of us, when we're so sick, we won't be able to go to sleep on our deathbeds. We won't be able to be content or full of energy, or even energetic and joyful, and be able to watch even your breath. But it never means you don't meditate. You're happy to be here. Where you are becomes where you want to be. In other words, there's no wanting for anything else. Content, happy to be here. No ill will, no wanting things to be different. No craving. Then, what other people say is sickness, for you, you can make peace with. Pain. If you want to be here, then the pain is not a problem. If you want to be somewhere else, then it's a problem. Even a small itch, an irritation, if you don't want to be here, then it's huge. So, that is how. I thought that was actually the question anyway. Not what the question was, but it's a pretty good answer because you were paying attention. So what did you say to Ajahn Tate at the end? Did you two just eyeball each other and then some big monk carried you away? Did he say anything to you in words at all? I think in the end, I just said, oh, you know, I came here to ask some questions, but it's probably best we answer our own questions. Said, yeah, it's much better you answer your own questions. And I bowed and left. Basically, the silence and the kindness answered all the questions. So, all the questions are now answered. Can I get away with that? Yeah, okay. Are there any Buddhist temples or meditation halls you'd recommend in southeast Queensland that are aligned with the BSWA or teach similarly? I have been to a couple of temples which have been nice, however, a lot more rules. We have a rule here. What's the first rule in our monastic code and monastery rules? Yeah, compassion, be kind. Number one rule. That's really quite amazing. Be kind, number one. They have another set of rules. And what's the other set of rules? Rule number one? You know that, Venerable Metaji? What's rule number one? Yes. It's about the abbot.
Be kind to the abbot.
No.
You're supposed to be kind to the abbot.
No. Number one is the abbot's always right. What's the rule number two? That's right. If the abbot makes a mistake, refer to rule number one. But we have this other sort of rule. It's not really a rule, but I got this, the advice of a master to a student. So it was a master telling his student, please give me some advice. Some really deep advice. And so the master replied to his student, never argue with idiots. That was the advice. Never argue with idiots. You know, and the student said, that's not compassionate. And the master said, yeah, I think I agree with you. have a lot of fun playing with that. Anyway, yeah, I agree with you. So the person I can relate to your words, I don't know, because it's been a long time since I've been to Queensland, but just check them out. If they always have this problem, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. So if there's nothing there, make one. So don't need monks, maybe nuns. Any of you like to go to Queensland? not such a bad place. It's not like being sent to the end of the earth. Actually, the Ajahn Sujato has just moved back to Sydney. You know what he's called his temple? He's called his temple Lokanta. You know what that means? End of the world. So I don't know if people have got the message there that Sydney is the end of the world. That's what he's called his temple. World's end. Anyway, whatever. Is there any people from Sydney here? World's end. Ooh. There you got a temple there anyway. So actually I don't know because I don't have time to travel too much over to... spend all the time travelling overseas. Anyway, do these Thai amulets with the image of the Buddha or a senior monk protect the wearer? How does it work? Ah, great. Ajahn Chah would never, ever, 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 ever give out those amulets except once. And actually sometimes people would print out those amulets and sell them for a lot of money. And Ajahn Chah, if he heard about that, he would stop whatever he was doing, get a car and just confiscate them all. But anyway, one day this gentleman came up to him and said, look, sort of I'm going into the army, I've been conscripted, and on the borders there was still lots of fighting. And many people do actually get killed or wounded there. And so he said, can you please, 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 I'm a disciple of yours, can I have a little amulet, a little Buddha to wear around my neck to protect me from bullets? And I just said, no, I don't do that. And the gentleman was smart enough, he was prepared for that answer, that's what he expected. He said, but, in a little poor Ajahn Chah, that you had just gave a talk a few days ago about gratitude. And I have been feeding you, bringing food to the temple for years, and also with my father, and also I've been giving donations to your temple, looking after you, sometimes taking time off work and driving you here, driving you there. This is the first time I've asked for anything. And it's important, it's going to keep me alive. So, gratitude, Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, okay, you've got a point. I'll give you a Buddha to wear around your neck, which I guarantee will stop bullets. And this gentleman was just so happy. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Not only because, you know, Ajahn Chah, you know, old monks don't lie. He knew that if Ajahn Chah said it would stop bullets, it would. And so he was just so confident and also so special. This was the only person Ajahn Chah would ever do this for. And so he was so excited and said, well, can I have it? He said, well, you have to go and collect it for yourself. It's a big 3-meter-tall Buddha statue in the main hall. You wear that around your neck and I guarantee it will stop bullets. And that's the only one which does stop bullets. That's Ajahn Chah. So when you're asking a nice joke story from Ajahn Chah, that was amazing because, you know, it wasn't what people expected. And Ajahn Chah didn't lie, but it made a very strong point. That's the only one which does stop bullets. But anyway, still, there was all these stories. And one of those stories which did actually reach even Australia, I read it in the West Australian here. Somebody cut it out and showed it to me. There was a general in Thailand, major general, and he was boasting about his, this was how many years ago, 10, 15, 20 years ago, boasting about this amulet which cost him 500,000 US dollars, $500,000. I mean, that's a huge amount of money, especially in those days. $500,000. And he said, what? And he bought this because it's guaranteed to stop bullets. And he was wearing around his neck, and he ordered, just to prove it, it was in the officer's mess somewhere in Thailand, and he ordered his junior officer, some sort of lieutenant or major or something, ordered him, he gave him, the general gave the service revolver to the junior officer, it was loaded, he said, shoot me, I order you, because this is a very powerful amulet. So the junior officer, following orders, shot him. It was amazing. The general died. And that got in the newspapers, not just in Thailand, but in all over the place. So much for amulets stopping bullets. But some people have amulets, but what it's really there for, just to remind you, we have a Buddha statue to remind us of the Buddha and the qualities of the Buddha. But it doesn't do any more than that. If you think it's a lucky amulet, is it? Do you want to try it? Get somebody to shoot you? Anyway, it doesn't protect the wearer, except it just can remind you that it's something which is helpful. How do you turn a mere intellectual resolution, in other words, I will not judge myself or others, into an automatic emotional response? Well, you just make that resolution, I will not judge others, and if you fail to keep that resolution, you don't judge yourself for failing. That becomes easy. You understand the real automatic response is just basically common sense and kindness. Why would you want to judge other people? Do you really know what they did or why they did it? And kindness always gives people the benefit of the doubt. But anyway, what you're saying, a mere intellectual resolution. You repeat it, you hang around with other people who are good people, and you meditate, and it just grows on you, little by little. So sometimes the repetition is otherwise called brainwashing. And it does become an automatic emotional response. So this is actually how we what is it that, you know, sometimes I was wondering, you see, this small little animal, you bring in that little kitten, and everyone goes, ah, that's so cute, ah. And that's an emotional response. Doesn't matter, that little kitten might kill so many birds. But our response is, ah, to anything soft and fluffy. So there's some of our responses in nature, sort of are just, they've been, many times because we've seen it, we've learnt it in school. One of those emotional responses is when somebody dies. Shock. But people die. Sometimes you wonder just, don't people get it? Well, you know, if you're a real Buddhist and you get a call to say that somebody has just passed away, you said, yeah, I expected that. Why can't you say that? Because we all know that death can happen at any time. I was actually on a retreat, during a range retreat, a personal retreat, when Princess Diana died. And when I came out, people said, isn't it sad, Princess? What are you talking about, sad? Is she a relation of yours? Have you got a secret, having a secret love affair with her? Do you really know her? Oh, no, but it's sad. And where did it all come from? Because there's media blanket coverage. You had to feel sad. If you didn't feel sad, you know, maybe you think that, you know, that you don't care. It's not you don't care. You care for people. You don't have to feel sad to show that you care. So that sometimes that our culture demands a certain automatic emotional response. I first saw that. I was only sort of 16 when my father died at home. And my mother was doing fine. You know, just, you know, she knew he was going to die because he was very sick many times. Came very close many times. But then eventually, that when he passed away, that she was fine, and then until her sister-in-law came. And the sister was, oh, you poor thing. And straight away, the social cue, that my mother started crying. I realized that was actually just imposed by my auntie. She was fine beforehand. It's just like the emotional response. I remember once stepping on a nail, and it went just about through my foot. Rusty old nail, but it didn't hurt. Until somebody said, "Oh, that's terrible." And then it started hurting. The emotional response, I would say, was just triggered by my friend's emotional response. It's amazing. Now, are you smiling? You say, where did that emotional response come from? Triggered. So anyway, the emotional response is they are learned. Repetition. And if it's part of the culture, then it's very difficult to stop. But if we can sort of change cultures or just improve our culture, whatever that culture is, then it's amazing just what we can do. So that we don't need to quiet funerals. Why feel sad? Does that help? It's only because socially, if you don't feel sad when somebody dies, they think you don't care for them. My husband and I are thinking of letting go of the busy life in the city and moving to the countryside. However, our sons express that they don't want to move away from their friends, school, their soccer club and training, etc. How do you teach young children about letting go, not wanting more? Please help and advise. So, there's only, say, 7 or 9. Busy life in the city. You go into the countryside and do you think you're escaping from busyness? Sometimes I thought, when I become a monk, I can let go of all the busyness. Someone's already laughing, they know. To the point that I remember giving a talk one evening in Singapore. And at the end of my talk, question time, somebody came to the microphone and they said, "It's all very well for you to talk about stress and the problems of work and bosses from hell and family life and kids and stuff, but what do you know about stress, Ajahn Brahm? You're a monk." And then I answered him. I said, "Sir, this is what I have been doing since 4 o'clock in this morning when I woke up." And I just detailed all the jobs, and even like having breakfast, you know, is work. Because, you know, you've got to give blessings and talk to people and answer their problems. And as soon as you finish your lunch, you talk to them afterward about their problems and stuff. You know, monastic life is no such thing as a free lunch. And you can't go to the toilet, even though you really want to, because there's more people coming up to sign the books and take photographs, and it goes on, and then you have to go somewhere else to give a talk or to what. And it went on all day, and I'd been working. I listed everything I'd been doing since 4 o'clock in the morning. That was about 9:30 at this place in Singapore. And then when I listed all of that, the person who asked the question came back on the microphone again and said, "Wow, I never realized how much a monk has to work in this modern world." He said, "I always wanted to become a monk one day, but not now." My honesty has lost a monk. But anyway, so live life away from the city. Is that really going to overcome busyness? Is it? So sometimes, even in the city, it's not. I said this to someone today, that busyness is doing too many things at the same time. And sometimes you can get a lot done by just being with the person in front of you, being kind, being gentle, one thing at a time, giving this thing everything you've got. Get a lot done without being busy. So maybe you can let go first of all. even living in the city, and still being very peaceful. Can you please do the imagination of Buddha meditation you did this morning every day for 10 minutes? Oh my goodness. What you can do is every day you can sit down, close your eyes, and imagine I'm doing the imagination of the Buddha.
That was
very
strong. Sorry?
That was very, very strong. Yeah, it was, yeah. So it left an impression on you?
I didn't write that one.
Oh, yeah, okay, no. That's okay. But there is no self, so it doesn't matter. No one wrote that letter. But if you did, if that was whoever wrote that, it was very, very strong this morning, you really enjoyed it, then you can close your eyes and imagine that you're hearing Ajahn Brahm teaching the imagination of the Buddha. I'm trying to get out of it. Come on, I'm always too busy. But anyway, no, it's very strong. But it's recorded, so try that again. Because there's many other things I'm supposed to do. Anyway, let's see. I like reading the sutras from time to time. If, for time permits, don't have to be tonight, can you kindly share your favorite sutra with us? Also, how you were inspired by it with Mega Metta. P.S. Thank you so much for sharing a talk on the talkative tortoise and children's Dhamma meditation on pretending to be the enlightened Buddha. My favorite sutra. One of my favorite sutras is Sariputta was asked, sort of, you know, what is delusion? And he said, delusion is thinking suffering is happiness, and happiness is suffering. It's easy. So, just let go. I read in the book about dimensions, The Laws of the Sun by Master R. Okawa from Japan. The laws of the sun. Anyway, according to that, we live in the third dimension, which is the earth. Really? I know it's the third stone from the sun. I know that because that was a Jimi Hendrix record. Remember Jimi Hendrix, the third stone from the sun? No air guitar, please. And after our death, we will go to another dimension depending on the good and bad things we've done. However, I have never heard about dimensions in Buddha teachings. Has Buddha mentioned about dimensions? And if so, can you please explain with metta? So I'm full of dimensions. No, it hasn't. Not like that anyway. When you're on a personal retreat, there's an extra wonderful energy at Bodhinyana. Okay, like the Vietnamese monk in Sydney, this is a great teaching and inspiration. Perhaps you should do this more often. You're talking about me being on a personal retreat. You're trying to get rid of me. Send me on a personal retreat. Perhaps you should do this more often, 1 week in every month. Perhaps for the benefit of the very young Sangha at Dhammasara, half the time in their male guest quarters with an attendant monk, the nuns will always remember and it may fuel their practice in a way nothing else could, and this would ensure their survival, longevity, and importantly, the substance of nuns of those whom they will substantially influence. As you aren't getting any younger, I think this is a beneficial and official way of still teaching and inspiring as well as looking after yourself. So 2 weeks every month, I have to be silent. That's like sending me into solitude for bad behavior in a prison. But there's so many other... You try that and the people in Nottamara. What about Nottamara? Don't they deserve some help? What about all the other monasteries in the world? What about all the other people who support us? What about going to Sri Lanka? What about going to Thailand? What about supporting Fennel Chanda down in Albany? What about supporting Albany? No, she's in Albany. Fennel Chanda in England. What about the Albany Monastery? What about Newby Buddhist Monastery? There's so many things you have to do. And so what I will do over there, you want to have inspiration of the nuns, say, in Dhammasara. So what you can do, I've already showed you the power of visualization. So for 1 week every month, you can imagine Ajahn Brahm teaching the visualization of the Buddha in Dhammasara. Did I do that? No, that didn't work. How about a hologram? Will that work? No, it's nice. People have lots and lots of ideas. But you can't stretch it too far. What is the name of this book on the back? On the back of what? Karma for... Oh, this is the thing. I have to ask Bianca, because is that this piece of paper here? Karma for additional... I don't know. I haven't got a clue. Is there any time or day or situation, emotion, where meditation is not the best? Medication. So, no. It is... what's the best time to meditate? What's the worst time to meditate? Later, yeah. It's only now, so now's the best time to meditate. The worst time to meditate is later. Whenever later has to be. When I accept the enlightenment as the ultimate goal for a Buddhist, I have a simple question relating to those of us who may ultimately fall short of this goal. It's not the ultimate goal of meditation, of a Buddhist. The ultimate goal of a Buddhist is disappearing of all goals. No wanting. Ultimate goal? You never reach goals. They're always out of reach. Instead, you stop reaching. And then the goal appears. The end. Anyway, what would you say was the most important attainment or character trait of normal Buddhists should aim to exhibit? To be whatever. What happens to be right now? And to be at peace with yourself, whatever yourself happens to be. I'm not excluding myself from becoming enlightened. I'm just enjoy walking the path. Who's walking the path? Okay, this is my opening for the answer. It is Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Enlightenment is, but not a person who attains it. I love that. That's really good stuff. So in other words, the path is, but if you are travelling that path, if there's a person identified doing it, the path vanishes. But the more you disappear, the more it's not you. It's just this process. Five khandhas, it's not you. Then, the wider and easier the path is. And to make that very clear, sometimes people have put me on the spot and said, Ajahn Brah, you have written books about jhanas. You have taught jhanas in so many countries. Come on, Ajahn Brah, can you attain those jhanas? Is that what you do? And for years I was quoting the eighth paticca, which was you're not supposed to tell lay people, anyone who's not ordained, about your own personal attainments. So, but then after a while, in the West, especially say, come on, that doesn't really cut it. Let us know. So after a long time, I decided to come clean. And I said to people, and it's not the first time I've said this, it's recorded for posterity. Ajahn Brah cannot enter jhana. I can't enter jhana. And people say, you fake! You hypocrite! I've come all this way thinking that you're an expert and you know what you're talking about. Ajahn Brah can't enter jhanas. Ajahn Brah has to vanish first, has to disappear. Then the jhanas manifest. This is not a personal attainment. is not spiritual materialism. It's a vanishing act. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but there is no being to hang the medal on. Now if you get that, you understand one of the reasons why there is that rule there, that you're not supposed to tell people about attainments because it's not personal. It's not really attainment. That's why Ajahn Chah said you're supposed to be practicing to let go of stuff, not to attain stuff. So anyone who comes up and says they're enlightened, straight away, that's their fraud. But then say, well, isn't there anyone enlightened today? It's the wrong question. Even there was this old, I was a really neat monk, Sri Lankan monk. He was a contemporary of Bhante Gunaratana and Venopia Dasi and Venerable Narada. They were all and Venkatesri Dhammananda. There was this incredible vintage of Sri Lankan monks who went overseas and did such amazing work. And this was, he came to Perth a couple of times, really long time ago. Yeah, that's it, very good, Ananda Mangala, excellent. Good old Ananda Mangala. And, Venerable Gunaratana, Bhante G. He confirmed this when I saw him once, and he said, they were all in the Malaysian Brickfields Temple one day, just having a cup of tea. You know, all these really sort of famous Sri Lankan monks of the same generation. And these two fundamentalist Christians came in, evangelicals, to teach them about God and Jesus, and that these monks were on the wrong path. And this Ananda Mangala, he just looked at them straight away and said, get out of here, you bloody fools. He actually said that. And those evangelicals, they were so shocked they walked out. The monk's not supposed to say that, but it worked. And those other ones said, thank you, thank you, thank you. Not supposed to say that, but it worked. Thank you so much. He was really one of a kind, this Ananda Mangala. But a few times he came to Perth, he was a Trappist monk before. So that's why he just knew so much about Christianity. He was actually a close friend with Indira Gandhi. Indira Gandhi, yeah. Because actually they grew up together. He was, obviously he must have been really high born, and he was in the Congress. That's right, he was a leader, the head of the young Congress, the Indian Congress Party. And that eventually became a Trappist monk. And was really, really strict, and he thought, this doesn't make any sense after a while. And so they decided to become a Buddhist. And because he was a prominent person, being really a very close friend with the then Prime Minister of India, Indira Gandhi, at that time, and then they tried everything to make sure he didn't sort of disrobe from being a Trappist monk. He was just one of the stars which they could boast about. And in the end, he told us this. It's very funny. I don't know if I can actually repeat exactly what he said. He said, all these head theologians of the Trappist order, they said, well, at least become a Muslim. So you're not denying God. And the way he said it was just... So anyway, he was also the one when he was asked in public, are you enlightened? And his answer was a really neat answer. He said, I'm not enlightened, but I'm highly illuminated. I thought, well, that's really cute, because making the point, it's you're disappearing or vanishing. Everyone thought he meant highly illuminated. He said, no, not illuminated, eliminated. And so those sorts of people just innovate and just sometimes you can't actually sort of approve, I suppose, you know, not in public about telling those evangelicals to, you know, bloody well get out of here, you fools. But you can't really approve of that in public, but in private, yeah. Saved a lot of time. Anyway, what am I doing here? So that's about enlightenment, the ultimate goal. If you make it an ultimate goal, you'll suffer, like every other goals. So the self has to disappear. Enlightenment is not an attainment. Even jhana, you're vanishing. You're disappearing. That's one of the signs. What you thought you was you is not there anymore. Think about the Dharma during meditation. It's thought, past and future, in a comment. It is called a lingering obstacle. That is the Dhamma Vitaka. Think about the Dhamma. It's a hindrance. And that's in the Anguttara Nikaya. And when I sort of saw that, when I was reading the suttas, it stood out because, wow, I never expected that one. So, they have the ordinary stuff, the attachments to family, and the attachment what other people think of you and stuff like that, greed, hatred, delusion. But then the lingering obstacle is thinking about Dhamma. This is not the time to think about Dhamma until after jhanas. Because it's like, and I'm sure maybe you've experienced this, sometimes your mind is so clear, so you think. And you can give yourself some amazing Dharma teachings. Like you can give these great sermons. It's like Mara, the tempter, just the last trick in the book to actually to give you this. And you're not going to think about old girlfriends or making money or family or stuff. But think about the Dhamma. Stopping you being still to see that what you're thinking about is just an illusion. There's something much deeper than that. To still those thoughts. And then you see truth. When there are ripples on the lake, it always distorts the image. Always. The Dhamma is not thinking. Thinking obstructs seeing the truth. Afterwards you check you're not deluded. What you see is rational. It conforms. But you don't reach it by cognitive thinking. Because your cognitive thinking all comes from old views. Okay, here we go with good old flowerpot experiment, which the monks have heard so many times. Ever since I heard it from my good mate, Bernard Carr, a really close associate of Stephen Hawking's, but also into psychic research. We were in the same area. He was into psychic research, so was I, and we joined the Cambridge Psychic Research Society, Chasing Ghosts, and Astronomical Society, and Physics, and Buddhist. He was a Buddhist as well. So anyway, he pursued more of a path in psychic research and theoretical physics. And we caught up only just a few years ago at the big conference we had here, the 10th Global Conference on Buddhism. But anyway, he told us all about the flowerpot experiment done at Imperial College in London. So this, one of his mates, one of his friends, a very well-known professor of physics, scientist, he claimed that he could prove the existence of levitation. And he got a lot of prominent physicists, scientists, experimenters, some who thought they really were objective observers. And he said he was going to demonstrate levitation. He came into the lecture theatre with a flower pot. He carried it in to prove there's no wires or anything, and he placed it on the bench, which is, you know, in all these science lecture halls. And he said, I'm now going to levitate this flower pot. And he had all the cameras, video cameras, UV sensitive cameras, infrared cameras, everything, just to make sure that if it worked, it would be recorded. And then he said, I need your assistance. I want all of you to start chanting the holy word Om to create the right atmosphere. So I wish I could have seen this. But all these old professors, hardened experimental scientists, all going Om, Om, Om. And as they were chanting Om, the flower pot rose into the air. It worked. And they recorded it as photographs, videos of it. And afterwards, they asked some of these professors, and some insisted it did not rise into the air. It was on the table all the time. It never moved an inch. And they showed them the photographs. That's faked. I was there, I was watching with my own eyes. It never moved. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment, because the truth of the matter was, it was an experiment on psychology and how your views bend your perceptions. Because the truth was, there's a huge electromagnet underneath the bench. And when they chanted Om, was when they turned on the electric current, and as you would all know, when you turn on very strong electric currents, you can hear the hum of the AC current. The Om was just to mask the existence of electricity suddenly being turned on. It was a trick. But that wasn't the point of the experiment, was it did rise above the table. But because some of those experimenters thought it was impossible, it was blocked from their perception, their bare perception. The raw stuff which came into their brain was already bent, filtered by denial. It just couldn't happen. Therefore, they literally did not see it. For them, it was on the table all the time. That is how perception works. So, thinking about Dharma during meditation, stop. Otherwise, it's just old what you expect to see. Emerging from each meditation, I feel as though reborn a little bit wiser. Thank you for this opportunity. That's one of the reasons why Christianity thinks that they have a franchise on being born again Christians. Even if they are born again Christians, they're only born again once. Buddhists, we're born again thousands of times. So every Buddhist is a born again Buddhist. Well, you know, just only messing around. Why is it that I can see that emotions, so it's great that you're a bit wiser, good. Why is it that I can see that emotions such as anger, jealousy are not good for me, and I can feel that they're unpleasant, yet I cannot let them go? The anger eating monster trick works in meditation, but afterwards I still get angry for the same things. Is that just how it is? We have to keep letting go until one day we get into jhana and get enlightened? No, you get angry because you want to be angry. You're jealous because it gives you something to do. It supports your understanding and delusion about a self. If a self did not react, if you didn't want anything and get angry at things, you would disappear. You wouldn't be here anymore. Years ago, I thought I invented a really neat simile. And that neat simile was about grasping an attachment. And I thought, look at my hand, I'm always picking up things. I'm always, if I let that go and I grasp something else. You know, when I was a young monk, okay, just 23 years of age I became a monk, so I gave up sex and girlfriends. Then I really got into food. And so I let go of food. And then I got into cups of tea and something else. And it was hopeless. As soon as you let go of one thing, something else substituted for it. Always picking, and I noticed my hand always picking something up. We pick something else up. I'm holding these questions. Why am I holding those? I put them down here. But then I find I pick them up again. I'll pick something up. And then I thought, why am I always picking something? I've done it again. Just doing that doesn't work. So then what happened, I realized, well, this is what the hand does. The hand picks things up. It's its function, it's its nature. And there's only one way to stop grasping things with my hand. Cut off my hand. That's the only way. And then I use that simile for your mind, or rather your sense of self, who you are, always picks things up and grasps. So the only way to stop that grasping of jealousy and anger and wanting is to cut off the illusion of a self. Once that illusion is seen through, busted, seen as just not tenable, not there, it's just a fantasy which you have been, you bought into. Only then can grasping stop. You've cut off the hand. Only when you've seen through anatta, you're a stream winner. Sakaya ditti has been uprooted. Only then can you start working on letting go of greed, wanting, and ill will. That has to come first, that's the source. Doesn't matter how much I train my hand, you'll always pick up things. No matter how much you train your mind, unless you see through the sense of self, you'll always get jealous, you want things, you get irritated. And I thought that was such a really good simile. Until I was reading through the Anguttara Nikaya and I came across the simile of the hand. Oh my goodness, the Buddha got there first. But that was actually freaky, because I hadn't read that simile before, not in this life anyway. And to actually see your simile, which I really thought, you know, I'd sort of concocted, to see that right in the suttas, ooh, that was goosebumps. Ooh, what's going on here? So anyway, that's what happens. You can reduce anger and jealousy and wanting, but you'll only be able to reduce it, suppress it, make it less. Enough for you to get into those deep meditations and see the nature of the thing you call you, yourself. And once that's seen through, then you are free, able to let go of wanting and ill will. Before you can only reduce it. And then the jhana experiences give you the opportunity to really knock it and just change those old perceptions and habits. So, your job at the moment, if you're not a stream winner, is actually to lessen the anger and jealousy. No, it's not good for you. Lessen it until such point comes as you're free. Hindrances are loose enough to be able to get the jhanas and see really what's happening there. And once those great states of mind have shown you that you're not in there, that you've disappeared when you get into these jhanas, and then from that time on you can understand how sense of self, identity, is gone first. And then goes the lessening of things like jealousy. So thank you for tricking me into giving a deep answer. Not a joke, but a deep one. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not a person, not an identity that enters it. You don't attain jhanas. You disappear. It's not an attainment. It's a disappearing act. State of letting go. You mentioned that there was a better translation of giving up grief and covetousness of the world in the Satipatthana Sutta. Can you please kindly repeat the correct translation so it would be so helpful? There is no correct translation. There's only an improved translation. Because translations always include sort of some of the knowledge, the experience of the translator. Sometimes when people say, Ajahn Chah said, I was there for 9 years, I never heard him say that. And it's just a translation, interpretation. So that's why it's great, you have to go back to the Thai to be able to know what Ajahn Chah really said. Or even that's harder than that, it's Laotian. And even harder than that, it's Bangor Nok dialect, or Bangor. That was his home village. And that is the sort of the language he used. And sometimes you have to be from that village to understand his dialect. In the same way that sometimes you have to be a Cockney to understand some of the words. I haven't seen this guy for a long time. Good old George. He was such a thick Cockney accent that I was the only one in the whole monastery who could understand him. And other people had to ask me to translate. He's speaking English. But Cockney English. But really with a thick accent. Anyway, the translation I prefer, and it's, well actually this is pretty sort of easily understood and accepted, having abandoned the five hindrances. Or rather, no, not abandoned, sorry, that's the wrong translation. Having, what is it, suppressed, restrained is the word. Restrained the five hindrances. Vinaya. And Lokeya Bija Dhamma Nasang refers to the five hindrances, the Pajjanivarana. What is the meaning and significance of keeping hands in Anjali when chanting? And why does the Buddha have his hand fingers in different positions, almost mudras, Indian dance-like, in different depictions? Do these mean significant something? In the time of the Buddha, they probably didn't mean much at all, but then afterwards we had all these different mudras, and they were said to, it's like the culture, the history, the tradition, to signify so many different things. And this one, what did that mean? People said, stop, policeman. It just didn't mean that at all, it was like fearless. And some of the monks over in English monks, being quite irrelevant, when he said this, he put his hands here. That was symbolizing you're standing in a wall when a penalty kick, no, a free kick is being made, if you know your soccer. But, you know, that each one of these, they started being signifying something. Like, why did the Buddha have, like, flame on his head, or sometimes a little bun on his head? When we got the Buddha statue for Bodhinyana Monastery Hall, Ajahn Chakravo asked the artist, the sculptor, can we have just a Buddha without a bump on his head? And the sculptor said, well actually, that most people know that the Buddha did not have a bump like that on his head visible. Because there were stories when people would go and they'd meet the Buddha and they wouldn't know who they were meeting. He did appear just like, you know, a human being. And so, why do they have that? And it is because it symbolizes the Buddha, so people actually know that that is not somebody of about the same time called Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, who got statues of him, but he hasn't got any bump on his head or any flame. It signifies the flames of wisdom or whatever, but people would not see that when they saw the historic Buddha in that time. But it signifies things, and these signify things. It's a symbol. So when you see a Buddha, that is a symbol of something. And when you bow to that symbol, I've often said this, that when I bow to a Buddha statue, I'm bowed to what it represents. You don't ask for things like it's a god granting you favors. It's I bow to what it represents, and to me, I usually bow to virtue, peace, and kindness. You know, virtue, sila, and peace, not just ordinary peace, but samadhi, stillness, and the compassion and wisdom. So I always remember this is what's important in my life. And just seeing so many wonderful acts of virtue, goodness, trustworthiness. And I love bowing to that because I can recollect that and just see it, and that's just so wonderful to see. And the peace, the deep stillness in the mind, the peace in the community, the peace in the world, the peace in jhana grove, how quiet it can be. That's just gorgeous. I worship that. And lastly, the compassion and the wisdom, which gives you freedom and kindness. That's so easy to bow to. And when I explain like that, you get all sorts of people bowing to the Buddha. Because they're not bowing to Buddha, bowing to what it represents. Okay. One of those experiences that, because of some of the work I do, I was invited over to Christchurch Grammar School years ago to give a talk. And when I went, it's one of the top sort of schools over in Perth, Christian school. And when I went in there, it's Anglican, when I went in there, the chaplain, really good friend, what's his name? Frank Sheehan, yeah. Frank Sheehan, yeah. He was waiting outside together with the principal, who, you know, because the top Catholic Anglican still had to be sort of an Anglican, strong Christian. So as we're waiting outside for the kids to settle, he told me, this is a Christian school. We know you are Buddhist. You know, we respect your beliefs. And Frank says a lot of good things about you, Frank Sheehan, because we've known each other for a long time. But he said that we have a little shrine to Jesus Christ in there, so that when we go in there, the two of us will just bow, you know, lower our heads to that statue. And you don't have to do that, so don't feel that you have to do that. And I took the opportunity to actually to teach something, or rather to be stubborn and rebellious and cheeky, which is more like it. And so I turned around to the principal and said, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus Christ. And the way I said it, you know, was cheeky and just confronting and just, what the heck are you talking about? And I said, I can still see something in that statue, what it signifies, that I can bow to, that I can respect. Just like, you know, people can see something, and may not be Buddhists, see something in the image of a Buddha, which inspires them. It's one of the reasons why they have all these Buddha statues over in people's gardens. It's something which inspires them, a peace and kindness or whatever. And anyway, so I'm going to bow to what I see in your statue of Jesus Christ, which inspires me, which I respect. And so I did. And he was just taken aback. And then a couple of weeks later, they'd arranged a visit from some of the school kids to Bodhinyana Monastery. And he came with us, with them. And I took him into the hall in Bodhinyana Monastery. And we bowed to the statue of the Buddha three times together. The principal of Christchurch Grammar School and I. Because he understood it. He was just paying respect. He wasn't really bowing to idols. He saw something he could respect in that image. And that's what he bowed to. That was really cool. So that's actually why we have these things. They're symbols. Something we can actually reflect on. I am the talkative tortoise. You think you're the talkative tortoise. You haven't said much at all, but I've been talking so much every day for many hours, and in interviews, and in the morning, and in this evening, I talk very much. How do I stay quiet when it matters most? Where does it matter the most? Now. So if there's a reason, what was the other great little saying? If you can improve upon the silence, then talk. If you can't improve upon the silence, be quiet. So I think that, you know, talking as I'm doing, hopefully I'm improving upon the silence. But afterwards, you can't improve upon it, so be quiet. Do your emptiness, roundness, wakefulness. No, it's wakefulness, not wakefulness. They've got W-E-I-G-H-T. You spelt it wrong. To be wakeful, not wakeful. It's okay, I like that sort of stuff. How far should one extend compassion when one knows others are taking advantage of it? Ah, you've been taking advantage of me for the last, how many days now? So should I say, right, enough. I'm not going to let you take advantage of me anymore. Of course not. That's compassion. But if it goes too far, always remember the simile of the snake. Cassie's lost it now. That's the snake who is not allowed to bite because keeps five precepts. So how can you avoid being abused if you're not allowed to defend yourself? Or like, I don't know if I should be proud of this, but it was similar to Ananda Mangala, Get Out of Here, You Bloody Fools episode. So I was at my mum's house, not the house, it was just a council flat in London, and visiting, she was making my lunch. One meal of the day. And this was important for me. I didn't want it to be disturbed or ruined when somebody rang the doorbell of her apartment. So I answered it myself. Mum, I'll answer it. It was not sort of trying to be kind to my mum, it was almost like being kind to my tummy. So then I answered it, and here was a lady outside. She said, would you like to buy some gypsy heather? And the gypsies were like Roma people. They were quite disadvantaged, but they would go around house to house, just making a little bit of money here and there. I think they're called travellers now. Anyway, but by trying to sell little trinkets or heather. And I was very polite to her. I said, no, thank you. And then she said, if you don't buy something, I'll put a gypsy curse on you. Now, I thought that legitimizes my response. You try and be forceful on Ajahn Brahman, you'll get something back. So I stood up and I had all my robes on. And I said, don't you recognize that I am a Buddhist monk? My curses are much more powerful than yours. That's what I said. I must have overdone it because she turned around and ran away. Maybe I shouldn't have done that, but you know, well, I keep on saying maybe I shouldn't, but I keep repeating the story. But you know, I wouldn't curse anybody, but of course she didn't know that. But you know, just, you know, telling her that, be careful, you know, monks' curses are much more stronger than yours. But then it was just like the snake hissing. So when you really want to set boundaries, it's okay to hiss. But never bite. Good to hear. Oops, okay. Good to hear Ajahn mention about the power of visualization this morning. I find it very powerful personally too. Just wondering if the Buddha taught visualizations too. Yeah, thank you. Long life, Ajahn Donut. That's one of my, called Soapy K's, nicknames. And why do they call me Ajahn Donut? Number one, because you're round. Number two, because you're sweet. And number three, because? Nothing in the middle. Holy. Okay, anyway. What is a... Okay. Okay. Oh, yeah. The Buddha teach visualizations too. Yeah, they taught like nimitta. No, not nimitta. They taught, obviously, kasinas. These are the visualizations of colors. Recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. There's many things which the Buddha taught. And it's a skillful means. It works. Do it. What is the longest period that you have been in noble silence? It's, oh, for years and years and years we haven't had any bells in Bodhinyana Monastery. When was the last time we had a bell? We've got a bell there, we never ring it. That's what no bell silence means. And if we stop having bells and routines and schedules, then some people, because of the right causes, no bell silence, some people actually, they do win the no bell peace prize. Oh, come on! Oh, no. The Nobel Peace Prize, no bell. But no bell silence, you mean total silence? We're not speaking to anybody? It's the longest time you've spoken. Well, I suppose between your previous life and this one, I didn't do any talking. But I don't know what your longest period of days. The time when I never spoke to anybody except the kangaroos and this beautiful pair of eagles which I saw up in the forest. That was when I did my 6 months solitary. Bliss. Never saw a human being for 6 months. Never spoke, but I did do chanting to keep my voice active. But what happened there, that 6 month retreat, noble silence, really silence and solitude, so much joy and happiness. But what the trouble was, when I came out afterwards, 6 months, everything has to end sooner or later. I had to speak. People asked me, what did you do? What happened? And my brain couldn't think. And you had to speak, and that was just, I had a headache for 3 days. It's like you're just so cool until you had to wind up the motor again. I wasn't used to thinking. And so that was really a headache. So that's what happens when you have lots of silence. And some people were very disappointed, because they were waiting to see me. They hadn't seen me for 6 months. Just even in Bodhinyana Monastery, in one of the huts there. And they thought I'd come out like with big wild eyes and just really long hair, crazy. And then, yeah, that would have been sort of, you know, like even newsworthy. But anyway, we're very happy. Ajahn, dear expensive Ajahn. Okay, instead of putting dear Ajahn. Don't put expensive, priceless. This body and mind will die, sure it will, especially if I keep this Q&A going on any longer. It's already over time. This body and mind is making an effort not to identify its objects as I, just use body and mind to address this human. Improved non-identification, okay? Okay. In the first jhana, does this come to a state that 5 hindrances disappear totally or appear but get rain all the time? No, they're just gone. Need clear advice, Ajahn? No or yes? Yes. Wish this would be your and ours last life on earth, crossed out space. Wishes don't actually get you anywhere. It's just more wanting. So, instead of that, they usually say, may you all get lost. Okay, so now's the time to get lost, to lose everything. Sadhu! 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 Very good.